how far away is Russia? Well, in some ways, you really can see it from here. On Hometown Alaska today, we're talking about the Ice Curtain, that analog of the Iron Curtain standing between Alaska and the Russian Far East. Recently, Russian bombers have been kind of testing our military defenses, and that makes it seem very close. But back in the 90s, it seemed even closer as Alaskans and Russians were going back and forth and creating a lot of cultural and business ties and even political ties. It was an extraordinary era. And now as we look at conditions between Russia and the United States becoming very cold, once again, some people are thinking about how could we improve it from the Alaska perspective. So that's our topic today on Hometown Alaska. And I have two guests who are very well qualified to talk about this. Nils Andreasen is the executive director of the Institute of the North, which is a local organization that looks at northern issues and is involved in the Northern Forum and the Arctic Council and the international issues about the circumpolar north. Thanks for being here, Nils.
Yeah, thank you.
And David Ramser is an author. He's had a lot of other roles in politics and in journalism, but he's here today as an author with his new book, Melting the Ice Curtain, The Extraordinary Story of Citizen Diplomacy on the Russian-Alaska Frontier. And this is a story that some folks may not know about. Those who have been around Anchorage remember that at one time, primarily in the 1990s, there was an explosion of Russian-Alaska connections, which was unlike anything else seen in the United States. Thanks for being here, David.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And we look forward to hearing your questions. Perhaps you came over to Alaska during the ice curtain melting of the 90s, or maybe you were involved in some of these exchanges, or maybe you have concerns about what's happening now. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752, and you can get on the show with us by email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Well, let's orient the listeners a little bit, David Ramser, about what this period was all about. It was something that I think must be pretty unusual in world history to have a region like Alaska become so closely linked with a region like the Russian Far East. What happened exactly?
Well, for thousands of years, Alaska and Russian natives traveled back and forth freely across the Bering Strait to hunt and fish and share a common culture. And as a result of the Cold War in 1948, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover sealed the border with the concurrence of Joseph Stalin on the Soviet side and basically prohibited any travel across the Bering Strait starting in 1948. And that lasted for 40 years, really, until 1988. So there was no travel across the border. And starting in the mid-1980s, there was pressure to reopen the border. A lot of the Alaska natives had relatives on the Russian side, but they had not seen them for 40 years. And these people were getting older and they wanted one last chance to see their relatives. And you had a new reformist Soviet leader come to the Kremlin in the form of Mikhail Gorbachev, who was interested in changing his country. He extended authorities, the central authority of Moscow, to the regions and encouraged people in those areas to do business deals with the West. And so a lot of Alaskans, just average citizens, civic leaders, business leaders, saw an opportunity to rekindle relations across the Bering Strait with the Soviet Union.
And for a while, you had Alaska Airlines flying over there. You had Russian rock groups coming and playing in Anchorage. You had these sister city relationships, huge numbers of educational things happening. As I read your book, I was amazed at just, I would live through it, but I just didn't realize that the amazing magnitude of it.
It just boomed away. Alaskans and Russians could not get enough of each other during this period. After Alaska Airlines flew what was called the Friendship Flight from Nome to Providenia in 1988, it just opened the border to all sorts of groups. And there were more than a dozen sister city relationships established between Alaska communities and their Russian counterparts. Rotary clubs were very active. More than three dozen rotary clubs were set up in the Russian Far East by Alaska groups. 100 or so Alaskans and Russians even married each other, and a number of those marriages continue to this day.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of Russians in Alaska, and I guess this is one probably the biggest reason for that. So times have changed drastically, and the ice curtain essentially refroze, and there's much less of this exchange going on now. And in fact, relations between our two countries are probably as bad as they've been since the Cold War. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
I think that's probably true, yes.
Any lessons from this history that we can apply? And we can obviously talk more about that in the coming hour. But is that something you see, that there's something to apply from the 90s period that could be brought up to date?
I think there are some lessons that we can learn from this 30-year era. I don't want to be too naive about it, because circumstances have changed dramatically, at least in Russia. Putin has very different policies than Gorbachev. He's recentralized control into the Kremlin, and so people in the regions close to Alaska have no authority to negotiate business deals or civic deals. And it's really a hassle to deal with Russia these days. There are very limited transportation links between the two of us. But I think one of the lessons is the native relationships. One of the important legacies to come out of this era was visa-free travel by Native people, and that remains in existence. Mm. So Alaskan Russian Natives can travel back and forth.
I didn't realize that.
It's still burdensome. It's expensive. Takes a while, mm-hmm. but they don't have to have visas, which are even more burdensome than they were before.
Yeah. I want to turn to my other guest, Nils Andreasen, who is the executive director of the Institute of the North. Northern Forum and Arctic Council are the circumpolar organizations where nations who have Arctic concerns work together. Right. And so they're not the Washington to Moscow relationship. How do those relations go? Do you see the same chill there that we see at the national level?
Yeah, it's interesting in listening to some of the history described, because if you look at even the history of the Northern Forum, 20 years before the Northern Forum was officially established, which was in 1995, so back in the early 1970s, Hokkaido hosted a Northern Regions Environmental Conference with attendance by Alaska, Canadian jurisdictions, along with many Russian regions. And there's a spirit of cooperation back then that existed, that went away for 20 years and was rekindled in the early 90s, during much the same period that David's been describing. It was also at that time that the Arctic Council was formed, and its precursor was the Arctic Environmental Strategy. So you have just this broader spirit of international cooperation taking place between Arctic states, countries, but also at a regional level. In the last 20 years, since both of those organizations have been more officially established, you've got very, I would say, many paths to cooperation that bypass even today's current conflict.
Hmm. So give us an example.
So we haven't had, I think in our cooperation within Northern Forum, we've had pretty open exchange with member regions across Russia. Just last July, we hosted, I think, 9 member regions, deputy governors, ministers here in Alaska when the state rejoined Northern Forum. All of that very easily accomplished, and I've been back and forth a number of times since then. So really good cooperation between regions at a very specific level, I would say. So depending on which...
So around concrete issues?
Yeah. So, and it depends on which region you're talking with. So in Chukotka, it might not be some issues, but scientific cooperation and environmental protection are two areas within kind of the remit of the Chukotkan government that cooperation is very easy. Hmm. Energy, construction, design issues, very... those challenges to be addressed, very common across Russia, and a lot of interest in cooperation with Alaska. So it really depends on the region and how Alaska's interests intersect with that region's mm-hmm. interests.
How do these issues that David was referring to, like the difficulty of travel and the bureaucracy and sort of the general tightening of what people can do, how does that impact what you're doing?
Right. So I don't think I ever experienced, well, I think age probably limits my experience
in
that
the
realm.
Openness, yeah.
But I mean, for my participation then in the last 5-10 years in Alaska Arctic issues, it's been generally straightforward for our participation in Russian activities. Communication has been fairly open mm-hmm. and straightforward. So it's felt fairly comfortable. And maybe this is the new norm that I'm experiencing, where, you know, at a person-to-person level, communication and cooperation happen very easily. And but maybe on that business level or other aspects, that it's more challenging.
Mm. So you're able to just shoot off an email to someone in the Russian Far East who you need to do something with and just be in communication.
Yeah. Yeah. I think anywhere in Russia I can do that.
Yeah. So, and that's a far cry from what you describe in the book, David, where you can't even set up a flight because there's no way to even make a phone call. And so Alaskom, who is the telecom company in Alaska, has to fly over and set up an earth station so that there's a method of communication back and forth. It's amazing.
Yeah, technology changed dramatically, and I think it's eased communication across the Bering Strait. But still, it's really burdensome if you want to fly from Alaska to the Russian Far East. When Alaska Airlines operated for about 6 years, you got on a plane in Anchorage, and 4 hours later, you were in Magadan. It was as easy as flying to Seattle.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you want to go to the Far East, you're limited really just to a couple of options. You fly to Nome, get on Bering Air, and fly across to Providinia, and then from there, you try to get to where you want to go. Or you fly from here to Korea and then go up north along the Russian coast. Or you could do the around-the-world route and fly to Moscow.
Wow.
But that's just way too long.
Did you go over for the book when you were working on the book?
I did. I went twice in the last couple of years. I went in 15 to Western Russia, to Moscow, and some of the cities around there. And then last summer, I spent a little over 2 weeks in the Russian Far East. We went, flew into Providinia, and then we went up the Russian Bering Sea coast in open 18-foot whaleboats all the way up to the northeasternmost point of the continent and came back down.
That sounds like
the experience.
That sounds like quite the adventure. Tell us about that. That sounds dangerous, actually. You're in the ocean in a little boat, right?
Yeah, and actually we were pretty nervous about it. In 1995, there were 5 Western social science researchers who were over there doing something similar. They were in skin boats, and there was a terrible accident, and the 5 of them and 13 people total were killed when their boats went over. So that weighed on us pretty heavily. But there were 9 people, primarily Alaskans and a Mexican film crew, who did our trip last summer. And my point was to look at a lot of the villages that I had not been in since the 1980s to see how they had changed from the Soviet era to the current era when the Soviet Union has dissolved, and pretty dramatic changes over there.
Yeah, it's gotten better.
Nope. It's not necessarily. During the Soviet era, the Central Soviet government would pour a lot of resources into these villages. So you'd have a community like Providinia, which is very small, but they would have a dairy and a vegetable co-op and a garage for repairing vehicles. All that went away when the Soviet Union collapsed in 91, and now they're pretty much back to their subsistence roots, at least the northern native villages in Russia. They formed hunting and fishing cooperatives, but they're not those sort of economic enterprises anymore in those villages.
Wow. So it's sort of gone backward in terms of economics from sort of a modern Western feel to essentially a subsistence community.
They have. The ones that we saw were thriving, you know, reasonably well.
Mm-hmm.
They bring in supply ships in the summer, but they're basically ice locked for 6 months a year. And we saw fresh grapefruit and tomatoes in the stores. I mean, it was pretty amazing in this part of the world. But in the dead of winter, it's not like that at all. And people are eating whale meat and walrus and whatever they harvested in the summer.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
I attended the Arctic Territory of Dialogue just this last spring in March, I think, in Arkhangelsk. And it was, you know, between our relationship with the Ministry of Economic Development and then at that conference hearing their Ministry of Energy talk. There's a reorientation of Russian strategy for economic development that I think is, it's different than, you know, the U.S. approach. And I think there's something to be said for it. And beyond sectors, they've been focusing, or they will be focusing, on regional development. And some of the, I think, early targets are the Russian Far East. Especially in terms of energy, they're really focused on renewable energy development in the Russian Far East, which really surprised me because it's not something that I'd heard before. But this reorientation around Arctic policy for for Russia. It will be interesting to see how it plays out.
If they're really serious and putting their money where their mouth is,
right.
or if it's just talk, yeah. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about the Russian Far East and a new book called Melting the Ice Curtain, The Extraordinary Story of Citizen Diplomacy on the Russian-Alaska Frontier by David Ramser. It's just come out from Snowy Owl Books, which I gather is part of University of Alaska Press. I've read it. I've got a couple of chapters left, but I really enjoyed it because I found out that I knew a lot less about this topic than I did, and that the stuff that was happening was really exciting and unique and almost incredible as we learn the connections that happened between Alaska and Russia, just how much was going on and how significant it was for that decade or so that it was still happening. David Ramser is in the studio, as is Nils Andreasen, who's the executive director of the Institute of the North. And we welcome your calls here. The local number is 550-8433, 550-8433 for your questions about Russia. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752, and the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Well, I want to get back into some of your adventures that you had, David, because I gather you got arrested while you were on that boat trip. But, you know, just I also want to touch on what's happening in the news, because what I'm hearing here is such a contrast to what I'm reading in the newspaper. You know, in Syria, we shot down a Syrian plane, a Russian manufactured plane. Russia's now cut off our cooperation to avoid collisions and has threatened to shoot down our planes. And just a whole series of conflicts. I guess there's new sanctions going on. Obviously, the Russians interfered the U.S. election. We don't know how deep that went. As you said, the relations seem as bad as they've been in a very long time. Do you follow that? Is that something that you are, and are you concerned about those issues?
I do follow it pretty religiously. When I started working on this book, I subscribed to a lot of foreign policy blogs, and so I follow what goes on in Russia pretty actively. One of the persons who wrote a blurb for my book, an endorsement for the book, is one of the leading dissidents in Russia now, who was poisoned allegedly by the Russian government a couple times over the last year or so. So I do keep up. And it is quite troubling on the state of relations between the two countries.
Yeah, I just you just wonder if it can flash into something disastrous, if this kind of jostling, it can suddenly get much worse. And I don't know, what's your feeling about that? Is this something that's going to blow over, or what do you see as the main points of friction that could cause international relations to become even worse and perhaps more dangerous?
Well, given that I think a lot of people thought that Trump was willing to improve relations between Russia, things have turned south pretty quickly. Just on my way over here, I took a quick look at the internet, and Trump met with the Ukrainian president just a couple days ago. And one of the things he was able to leave Washington with was additional sanctions on Russia for their invasion of the Ukraine. And so I think things are getting a little bit worse. I do think, although I don't think it'll happen, that Trump has the opportunity, like Nixon going to China, to come up with some pretty groundbreaking policies with Russia. If he could persuade Russia to help in the Syrian war or to withdraw from the Ukraine. Now, again, I don't think those things are likely to happen. I don't think Trump has it in him, and I don't think that his people think that globally. But that's a possibility.
Right. I mean, part of what administration seems to be kind of frozen by the fact that they're in this Russian controversy. So it seems like the last place that they would be able to really do anything, if they can do anything at all, when they're so mired in investigations and everything else.
Yeah, I think the progressive policy would be viewed pretty skeptically by the public and by Congress.
Yeah, I think so. We have a caller. Ed is calling from Palmer. Ed, go ahead.
Yeah, I was involved in, my wife and I were involved in the Alaska-Russian exchange back in the 90s, don't remember just when. We had a comprehensive horticultural history hay farm there, and we were asked by, I don't even know who, we were so busy, probably the Division of Agriculture, I guess, to be involved. So we had, I could talk all day about it, but I'll try to keep it brief. We had farmers from the Siberia area. We had young people who were the equivalent of our Boy Scouts. And the idea was that we were to share information with them, show them around, spend the better part of a day with them, and then keep one of the young people with us and actually hire them for a day. And they'd work with us, and we would pay them our regular scale, and they would learn something about farming. Just to give you a little bit of a picture of what we were doing, we had just a young fellow working for us. We were farming 100 acres, my wife and I, and usually just one kid, or we hired more when we needed them. And as I said, the farm was a comprehensive horticultural hay farm. So some of the experiences we had from it was bicultural learning experience. We learned a great deal from them, and I'm sure they learned a lot from us. And some of the things that I thought stuck with me over the years has been how they were amazed at, even though there were similarities between the cooperative farms in Russia, as well as the ag parcel, the state ag parcel that we had at the time in terms of the relationship with the state, they couldn't understand such things as private property and how we could own our equipment, and mostly, where were the people? They didn't understand how we could do that by ourselves.
Right.
That was some of the things we learned. They learned from us. My wife is a Yupik Eskimo, and one of the ladies there was a bureaucrat, and she was from Pravidania, and they had a wonderful time sharing experiences. My wife is a fluent Central Yupik speaker. She cannot converse at all with Siberian Yupik. However, she could have some sharing words with the lady from Pravidania. The one experience I would like to share was a young fellow that worked with us, a 17, 18-year-old. The fellow that worked with us was about the same age. And I said, now, you're going to be responsible for him someday. And I laid out the work for the day. And the anecdote that I thought was amusing but also very revealing to all of us was we went to have lunch, and we invited him to have lunch. And so he ate, and then he left. He went off to do his own thing. We had a four-wheeler, and when we finished our lunch, we went out, and the four-wheeler was gone, and he was gone. But where in the world did he go with the four-wheeler? All kinds of things came to mind. Well, I said, get in the truck and go down and see if you can find him. So there he was, a mile or so down the road, having a wonderful time. And we talked to him and asked him, just a big smile. But the thing that came across to us was in their particular cultural situation that was perfectly acceptable. Everybody owned everything, and you just, if you wanted to use something, you just went and used it. So it was a wonderful experience. I would love to see that reestablished. So that's my story.
Yeah, that sounds so similar to some of the stuff I read about in David Ramsey's book about businessmen going over to Russia, and then the folks in Russia want to do businesses, but they don't really understand the idea that you have to own something, right?
Right. Well, I think one of the most important legacies of this era is just the cultural understanding that we got of each other. People may not remember that the University of Alaska established something called the American-Russian Center, and they taught Western-style business practices, basically how to be a capitalist, to an estimated 60,000 Russians during this period, thanks largely to earmarks from Senator Stevens. About $26 million went to the university. But it opened the eyes on both sides of the border. I remember taking Russian visitors to my house down to Cars, and they would just break down in tears at the vegetable selection and then the produce, because they'd never seen anything like that.
Ed, did you feel that there's anything concrete that came out of this exchange, or was it more of just of a learning experience that was something that you could value as a memory?
That was exactly my experience. I think that was the most rewarding part of all of it.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for calling, Ed. Nils, in Russia today, it's essentially been a capitalist country for a while. Are these problems that David and Ed are talking about, have those been resolved in terms of people knowing how to run businesses and how to, you know, function in sort of a capitalist society?
To some extent, sure. And there's this wonderful example of an entrepreneur in Yakutia and Yakutsk, the capital in Sakha Republic, a guy who owns a business, a restaurant, has climbed Denali, is a photographer, is a filmmaker. He was here just last month, I think, with his film. But just an amazing individual, just completely fluent in how to operate within kind of both worlds. And I think that there's those individuals very similar across Russia. And a lot of them have had and benefited from connections and relationships with Alaskans.
David, in the book, you kind of talk about people who were able to sort of make it because they had a lot of ability to hustle during sort of the Yeltsin era. And they knew how to work the system, and they knew how to be very fast and nimble and make deals sort of under the radar. But there was this desire to build sort of regular business institutions that would be sort of more long-lasting. And has Russia sort of made that transition now to beyond the sort of the hustle economy to sort of like what we would recognize?
I think they have. When I first started going to Russia in the mid-1980s, you would go into shops in the Far East and there would be hardly anything on the shelves. And just last summer when I was there, even some of the most remote communities in Russia were just full of consumer products. So at least internally, they've learned how to do a little bit better on supply and demand. So all the decisions are not made by some bureaucrat inside the Kremlin.
Right, right.
But in terms of joint ventures with the West, it's still challenging. I think the one that's really the only healthy relationship now where Alaskans are working are in the oil and gas fields in Sakhalin. Some of our oil industry folks are working over there. But there are very few, if any, joint ventures anymore of the type that were started in the 80s and 90s.
Well, just as a newspaper reader, I would be concerned as a businessman in Russia that I could have my property seized, or I could be arrested, or I could be poisoned or something. I mean, it seems like the rule of law is a little bit shaky if you go if you cross the Kremlin or go down the wrong track. Am I exaggerating?
I think that's probably accurate. I mean, certainly there's that potential. I do think it's different in different regions of Russia. We went to Murmansk last September, and a very different perspective than in Yakutia or Arkhangelsk or Salakhard. So depending on where you're at in Russia, that level of experience and whether it's westernization or, you know, whatever that is very different. And I think Murmansk benefits from the relationship with Finland and Norway in ways that, you know, we can't comprehend and which we'd love to, I think, see develop between Alaska and Chukotka similarly.
Murmansk is all the way on the other side
of
the country. The geography is something we're not very good at here.
Right.
At least I'm not. And we have just a minute to talk to Jim from Wasilla, who is calling in before we take a break. Jim, do you have a quick one for us?
Yes, I participated in the marketing that went on in downtown Anchorage at the Eagan Center, where the Russians brought over a lot of the manufactured products and sold them there when that thawing portion took place. And I still have a great big old leather jacket that I bought that I've got to do something with it. I'm not wearing it anymore. But it was kind of fun to talk to people and see the goods that they had. And there's still a lot of the products had the hammer and sickle symbol on them, if anybody knows what that means.
That sounds like that would be a great souvenir to have these days. And you'd probably be able to sell it a lot, for a lot in someplace like Brooklyn or San Francisco. David, you talked in your book about this craft fair that took place where the Russians came in with like tons and tons of stuff, a huge load of stuff, and they'd paid no duties on it. And so there was a huge snafu where a large amount of money was resolved. And the Anchorage community really stepped in. To tell that story briefly.
Yeah, I think this was in 1989, right after the Friendship flight, 6 months after that flight. And an estimated 100 Russians flew into Anchorage for a week of rock and roll concerts, as well as buying Matryoshka dolls that they brought over in their airplanes. And part of the problem was that the Russians had no appreciation for the tariff situation in Alaska, and they wanted to sell hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of goods, but they couldn't get them through airport customs. So the congressional delegation and Governor Cooper at the time had to intervene. And Alaskans, in one day, I think, spent $100,000, which is enough to post the bond to get the goods out of Hawk at the airport. So it all worked out in the end.
So people had to sort of like went way out. And Dixie Belcher. Yeah, she was an amazing character in the book with all of her mortgaging her house to support this stuff and constantly be on their verge of going broke. It's kind of an amazing story how this whole thing was like a wobbly bicycle on a tightrope, but always seemed to stay upright. We're going to talk more about that. Thanks, Jim, for your call. We'll be coming back after a short break with Nils Andreassen and David Ramser talking about Alaska's relationship with the Russian Far East, how that's changed, and the heyday that it had about 20 years ago, and your questions. I'll give out those phone numbers and email address when we come back from this break.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. We're talking about Alaska and the Russian Far East, the connection that we've had for a long time, for thousands of years, obviously, that really reached a red-hot peak about 20 years ago and now is once again pretty cold. And also the current situation between our country and Russia, this former superpower, which is still so important on the world stage. I have two guests in the studio. David Ramser is the author of a new book, which is now on sale, Melting the Ice Curtain, The Extraordinary Story of Citizen Diplomacy on the Russian-Alaska Frontier. Kind of will always probably be the definitive work on this topic. It really covers it, and it's a good read. And also Nils Andreasen, who is the executive director of the Institute of the North here in Anchorage. And we welcome your calls. Here's the phone number to get on the air with us, 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752, and the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Nils, we were talking a little bit about the conflict between our country and Russia. I certainly grew up in the shadow of the Cold War. I remember getting under desks in Anchorage because we were afraid of nuclear conflict. Now the conflict is heating up again. How has that affected the kind of work you do in these Arctic exchanges and the work you do looking at circumpolar issues?
Yeah. For most people who are working on Arctic issues, I think there's just a lot of prayer involved that the conflicts outside the Arctic don't impact the cooperation that's taking place there. And that's certainly my case. I mean, we look at what's going on, the rhetoric or reality in D.C. or Moscow in relation to actions elsewhere in the world, and hope that it doesn't impact all the many levels of cooperation that's taking place in the Arctic. And I think it's especially important in terms of, you know, geography, even. I mean, Russia is 40% of the Arctic. It's our second closest neighbor if you're Alaska. It's not if you're anywhere else in America. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot to be said for where Alaska's positioned in relation to Russia, but also in relation to the rest of the Arctic. We talked a little bit about Chukotka, which is, you know, right...
Yeah, we're talking about we think of Alaska as being so huge, but when you look at the map in David's book, you realize that this region we're talking about is like dwarfs Alaska. I mean, right. It's massive.
Yeah. And there's so much diversity between the regions in Russia. I mean, you can think of it in terms of diversity between Alaska and Greenland, if you're looking for a North American context. But I think you've got, you know, Chukotka, our nearest neighbor. We have just south of that, we've got Magadan, where we've got a sister city relationship still. Yakutia or Sakha Republic is kind of that Siberia right in the middle.
So is that that's another step to the west of Magadan?
Another step to the west.
Okay.
And just north and west of that, you have Yamal, which is where I should have a map in front of me. Dave's got one in his book. But I'll just, I think Yamal, where they just have this large natural gas find, a lot of develop. I mean, the entire northern sea route is reorienting around the Yamal prospect and the oil and gas development, the gas development that'll be taking place there. You can go further, and you get to Salakard, you get to Arkhangelsk, Murmansk on the eastern, mm-hmm. Western border, and both very European, European-ish, with between their connections with Finland and Norway for Murmansk, and south of that, St. Petersburg, which is just almost an entirely different country.
Now you're over in Europe.
Yeah.
So it's a country that spans two continents.
Yeah, and I mean, those are the main kind of Arctic regions that we deal with the most, and they're hubs of industry, of transportation, of search and rescue, research, and there's connections to each of those that we have in the Arctic.
Yeah. So let's take a couple of phone calls as we continue to talk about this topic on the Russian Far East. Gene is on the phone from Anchorage. Gene?
Yes, hello. Thank you for having my call. I was a volunteer driver when the Russians, about approximately 100 Russians, came over here for a week. And we had this program. We had vehicles and a fleet of vehicles and a lot of volunteers driving people around. This was all organized by and handled by the amazing Vic Fisher. He was basically running this. So a couple of things that happened. I got to drive the governor of Magadan around a couple of times, and I'm thinking, wow, this is amazing. I'm having new hope for the whole world here, that this is pretty cool that these people are coming over here and actually seeing how we live.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time, we had a company that was making vodka here, and I had a reporter that was touring around looking at stuff. The reporter was from Moscow, and we went to this place where they're making vodka, and it was called Atikiska. So he sampled this Atikiska vodka, and I asked him, I said, well, how was that? And he says, oh, he said, very politely said, well, that was pretty good, but that's no Stoli.
Yeah, right.
So anyway, I just had this hope that we, making all these connections that hopefully would last, would help the world out a little bit.
Yeah, I think we all did, and maybe they did, who knows. Thanks, Gene, that's a great memory. I want to go to another caller, Tandy, who's calling from Anchorage. Tandy?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I just thought I'd share a couple of examples of my 25 years of working in the Russian Far East. You know, when Alaska Airlines and Reeve and Aeroflot were flying over quite frequently to the Russian Far East, I would find that there were many Alaskans who went over as tourists on some of those tourist flights. And then they came back as businessmen because they saw the opportunities that were available over in Russia for business. And we did have some really successful business exchanges. The other thing I wanted to mention, I also was fortunate enough to work with Vic Fisher on doing some training for some folks from Chukotka. We were able to bring over many native people from the local communities over to train them on how to be tour guides and run a tour company. And, you know, those connections are still alive and well. In fact, I was with David on his whaleboat trip, and every village that we went to were the people that were running the tourism operation there were students that I had 17 years ago. And so those connections are still there.
It worked,
like,
yeah.
David says in his book, this people-to-people diplomacy is still there with us.
That's great. And it's really good to hear that these, whenever you invest in people, the investment is never wasted.
Charles, could I put in a quick plug for Tandy there?
Please do.
She's one of the people that is still trying to keep this effort alive. And what she's trying to organize this summer, actually, is a reunion between Native people on Little Diomede Island on the Alaska side and several of the villages on the Russian side. So she's bringing Native folks together for a reunion to rekindle their cultural relations and subsistence hunting and fishing as well. And there's very little of that going on. And Tandy deserves a lot of credit for attempting to continue to do it.
Well, good for you.
Thank you very much.
And I think everyone here is a fan of Vic Fisher. If Vic is listening, he should call in. David, I want to hear more about this boat ride because it sounds like it was truly an epic. And you were mentioning before the show that you ended up getting arrested, which is not something we all want to brag about. But tell us what happened.
Well, this is considered a very sensitive area, the region of Chukotka, directly across the Bering Strait from Alaska. It's a special border zone.
Mm-hmm. And this is the ride, the voyage that you took in a small open boat just like a year or two ago, right?
Right. Last summer, there were nine of us in three open whale boats, so there were about four or five people in each boat. We hired native crews to drive us up to the top of the Asian continent and back. And everything went fine. Tandy, to her credit, got all the necessary permits well in advance. But one day we ended up taking a drive between two villages, and the permit that we were required to have was mistakenly left in the village that we had left that morning. It was just a day trip. So we arrived in this community of Lavrentia. Border guards boarded our bus and demanded our permit for being in the special border zone. And oops, we had forgotten it in the previous village. And so we were detained for 16 hours, held at the border guard station for lack of this permit, paraded in front of a federal judge, each pled guilty to failure to have this permit, and fined 500 rubles each, which was about
$8. $8, wow.
There's a lot of petty harassment like this of Westerners, and I think that's one reason why it is so difficult to deal in Russia, and particularly in the Far East, is because there are a lot of examples of this sort of petty harassment of Westerners.
Yeah. So, and this is coming about as part of a policy change. I mean, Yeltsin went out and Putin came in, Putin decided to centralize power, and he didn't want people running around in the Russian Far East. And I know some folks who were working there, like Andrew Crow and John Takotsky and Vic Fisher, weren't able to even go there any longer. How was that accomplished? Was it just an edict that comes down and says, you're done, you're not doing this anymore?
Well, pretty much. And then the National Duma, the national legislature in Russia, has passed a number of laws that make it difficult for Western organizations. A lot of the nonprofits that have done good work in Russia have to register with the Russian government and are deemed agents of a foreign government. And so they have a very difficult time operating in Russia these days. That is true of a number of religious organizations as well. So I think there's a general policy that's advocated by Putin to make it difficult for Westerners to have positive interactions in Russia.
Which is all a part of sort of the remaking of sort of this Russian attitude or this empire attitude. Yeah. So when this curtain again fell, did a lot of the businessmen who had gone over there to do stuff lose their money? I'm just curious because I've heard different stories. I've heard some stories where people seem to have been successful in starting businesses over there, and then others where, you know, the huge investments and disaster. And give us a sense of how all that worked out economically for those guys.
Well, there were just dozens and dozens of ideas for joint ventures on the Russian side, and some people actually did pretty well. There's a fellow that used to work for ARCO here named Dave Heatwall, and he was a businessman who represented Carr Gottstein. He successfully sold American hot dogs and frozen strawberries in Magadan. Mm-hmm. They were quite popular at the time. There's another case, a fellow named Doug Drum, who runs Indian Valley Meats down in Indian. He's sort of the classic example of an Alaskan who went over for all the right reasons to teach Russians how to process reindeer not so wastefully, and he got taken to the cleaners and lost a couple million dollars in the transaction. And so he's the example that sort of that people look to and say, maybe I don't want to do business in Russia
mm-hmm.
anymore.
Mm-hmm. It's Hometown Alaska. We're talking about Alaska's relationship with the Russian Far East. David Ramsey, who was just speaking, is the author of Melting the Ice Curtain, The Extraordinary Story of Citizen Diplomacy on the Russian-Alaska Frontier, new from Snowy Owl Books. Nils Andreasen is with us. He's the executive director of the Institute of the North. Well, let's, and we welcome your calls. We've got about 15 minutes left, so if you want to call, now's the time. The number is 550-8433. 550-8433, and the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. I'd like to move into sort of the more, maybe talk a little bit about how could we bring this back? You know, what are the lessons from then that can be applied today? Because I think we'd all like to see an improvement in relations between these two regions. Do you want to start, Nils, and like your thoughts on sort of where what's the step forward You mentioned sort of the nervousness about Moscow coming down on top of us, but what can we do working with our neighbors?
Yeah, but no, I mean, I think in the 20 years or so, I'm looking at the title of David's book, this Citizen Diplomacy. I think that's been formalized since those early years, and governments and organizations have taken up a lot of that citizen diplomacy and done a variety of things to it. So you still have quite a few delegations brought over from Russia to Alaska via U.S. federal agencies. So we've helped organize a couple different study tours for Fish and Wildlife Service or Forest Service. National Park Service for many years hosted the Beringia Days Conference. I actually think the Beringia Days Conference could be perhaps the greatest impact for Alaska-Chukotka relations. Just an opportunity to bring both sides together in Nome or Kotzebue or Anadyr. And share culture and science and all the other stuff that makes up good relationships. So I also think, you know, that for each of those study tours, they're done very specifically and outside the realm of citizen diplomacy. There's not a good chance for people to connect with the visitors coming over. So I think when those kinds of opportunities come up, making them more public, giving some public engagement opportunities is really important. I think take advantage of the states rejoining the Northern Forum. I'm supposed to be in Ханты-Мансийск at the end of this month, joined by fellow Northern Forum members talking about Arctic issues and cooperation. Invest there, and there's a lot of opportunity to share, engage. And then through the Arctic Council, there's any number of different projects going on. Russia's co-lead on a project that we're working on, the Arctic Energy Summit in September. And has contributed a number of speakers. So there's a couple of different
veins.
There's
stuff going on. Yeah. David, any lessons that you can take from the 90s period that would be useful today in trying to improve Russian-American relations?
Well, I think Nils is correct in pointing out that I think the Arctic is the area of best cooperation between us and Russia. The Arctic is very important to Russia, as he said, and the only reason, of course, the United States is an Arctic nation is because of Alaska. So I think we can play a key role. There's a lot of paranoia on the American side about the militarization of Russia. Russia's opening something like 50 new military bases in their Arctic.
Wow.
If you ask the Russians what's going on, they say it's primarily for search and rescue and to protect their commercial interests for shipping. But I know that the American military are pretty concerned about that. And ironically, when the Arctic Council was formed more than 20 years ago, jurisdiction over military operations was prohibited at the American insistence. And so I think that's one area that needs to be changed in the operating procedures of the Arctic Council to make sure it's a more effective international organization.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Let's go to Dan, who's calling from Anchorage. Dan?
Yes, thank you, gentlemen. I just thought I would let you know and also thank Tandy. Tandy helped us organized a flight in a small airplane, a Cessna 172. We flew from the Anchorage area up to Nome, and then from Nome on a VFR route, Route B-369, that myself and my friend helped organize some years ago. So we were able to fly that route from Nome up to Wales and over to Botany right near the Diomedes, then over to the Russian mainland and down to Providence Bay. We had been delayed a day or so for weather in Nome, so we only ended up staying there the one day. But our goal was to, improve relationship with the Russians there. And that route hadn't been used with VFR aircraft for nearly 12 years.
Wow.
So we were able to accomplish the goal, and we're really pleased about it.
Great. Thanks for that contribution. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
John is calling from Anchorage. John?
Good afternoon. I just was listening with interest on the program as I was involved in the small ship cruises from Nome, Little Diomede, Providence, over to Yanrakanot, Whalen, and back to Sabunga and into Nome. And it's really too bad that it couldn't continue, because it was one of the highest rated programs that we had at that time. And this is a vessel of 118 passengers. We weren't the first ones to blaze that trail, but I was there on a couple of the trips, and it was absolutely fascinating. I can tell you that the people of the region, whether it was Serenity or some of the other areas, it was just such an eye-opening experience for so many of our guests who were looking to do something truly different, and boy, they found it with this one. And I'm firmly convinced that if we were to iron out these business problems, because yes, we experienced several of those while in port. If we could iron those out, it would be an absolute fantastic program, because it was a small ship. It didn't inundate the community, but a lot of wonderful ideas and culture was shared. We had former Governor Jay Hammond as one of our guest speakers, and he was an absolute rock star when he got to Serenity.
Yeah. Why was that unable to continue, John? Why did it not get repeated?
Well, I can tell you for a couple of reasons, one of which was just, our guest speaker has said earlier, it's just a tough place to do business. We would arrive in port with all of our paper lined up, all of our guests ready to get off to disembark in Providencia, for example, and the Russian border guard would say, "Nyet," and then it came down to, gee, if we had a fax machine, maybe we could make this go easier. So, there would be things like fax machines and other things that we probably have to sometimes, how do we say it, pave the way. Or
so there's a bribe, basically.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We got shut down for that, and that could go on. But if it was a more stable, business-conducive environment, there is absolutely no doubt that this would be a wonderful destination and one that does very well.
Yeah.
From an operational point of view, you didn't burn all that much fuel when you consider how close we are from Nome to Little Diomede and then on down. It was an easy trip, but it was unbelievably worlds apart in terms of what people got quick exposure to at one night out of Nome. So it was truly an amazing experience.
Yeah, remarkable. Thanks, John. That was a great call. It strikes me, David Ramser, that without communication links and these things that you worked on building during that melting of the ice curtain period, without easing some of these complications, not much else can happen. That we've got like 20, 30, 40 flights a day to Seattle and zero to the west. We're naturally going to orient towards the direction where all the communication, all the transportation is. Do you think the transportation and opening up some of these barriers is kind of a prerequisite to having these sorts of relationships like build?
I do think it's a key. There are a couple of ways to get to the Far East through Bering Air out of Nome. There's a Russian carrier that operates in the summertime, just charter service to a couple spots for about 6 weeks in the summer. A number of people like Jim Stemfel from Nome have proposed a ferry between Alaska and the Russian Far East that never got off the ground for a variety of reasons. Maybe we should have talked to the Matsu Valley before they unloaded their hydrofoil ferry. But I do think that that's a key.
Yeah. Nils, one of the things that I've struggled with in sort of the Russian and the Arctic stuff is that a lot of it seems not super relevant to people in Anchorage, to people in coastal Alaska, sure. And that we're really more and more just part of the continental United States. And this Arctic stuff is important for oil and gas and for resources, but it seems it's kind of out of sight, out of mind for most Alaskans. Do you struggle with that a little bit?
Constantly. And I think it even ties back to your earlier question. And to a large extent, it's about market. So our market or economy of scale is north-south, and so would be the Russian side. It's not, we don't form a common market in any way that makes sense to Alaskans or Russians. Mm-hmm. So those market conditions really affect the relationships that we have. And they affect the way we approach Arctic. If we're not seeing some economic benefit from these broader Arctic conversations taking place, especially within an Arctic Council context that doesn't make policy decisions or spend money in Alaska, it doesn't make so much sense for Alaskans. I would say that, you know, especially for Arctic Council, for eight Arctic states, you know, they're negotiating between themselves environmental protections related to black carbon, all kinds of pollution type events, emergency response, oil spill response, search and rescue. All of this stuff is going to come back to Alaskans in one way or another through domestic policy changes. Climate change negotiations that take place, sustainable development, it's all there as part of an Arctic conversation, and all of it's going to come back to and should be informed by Alaskans.
Mm-hmm. David, and we just have a couple of minutes left. Are you going to be presenting with your book, or do you have any talks planned or anything you'd like to let folks know about?
This Friday, I'll be at the UAA bookstore from noon to 2 to do a presentation, and the following week, starting July 4th weekend, I'm basically going to start traveling around the state, talking to Rotary clubs and chambers and historic groups. I've got a website that people can look at that gets information about that. But yeah, I'm basically going to hit the road. I've also, when I worked in Washington, D.C. the last couple of years, I made some connections with some of the Russian think tanks back there. So I'm going to try to get a little bit of national coverage of the book, just because I think Alaska-Russian relations are an important story for the rest of the country to appreciate.
Yeah, very much so. And if folks want to find your website, just Google Melting the Ice Curtain should probably do it, I would think.
Right.
Yeah. So, and this is maybe a funny question for the last one, but maybe it ties in with what you just said. Sort of what's the overall goal for the book? Do you see a chance to renew this kind of thing? It seems like almost a once-in-a-lifetime thing, or is it just that we can learn something from what happened in the past?
Well, I think two things. It was an important history in Alaska's, or an important era in Alaska's history, so I think it needed to be documented. And a lot of the key pioneers are starting to fade from the scene, so I thought it was timely to do it now. But I do think there are a number of lessons that we've discussed today that can be applied to overall relations between the two countries that are important.
Is there any chance that we could have another time period like that happen, or would that mean somebody other than Putin in the presidency?
Yeah, I think we'd have to have dramatic changes, particularly on the Russian side. And given who's in our White House, probably changes there as well.
Yeah, that's right. It's looking a little bit discouraging, but it is hopeful when you go back and read about what's possible and what happened in the past. It really opens your eyes to the ability of people to open up across the border. Great. Well, thank you so much. My guests today have been Nils Andreessen, who is the executive director of the Institute of the North, which is an NGO involved in the Northern Forum, the Arctic Council, and does a lot of this international stuff. David Ramser, whose book we were talking about, the book is called Melting the Ice Curtain, The Extraordinary Story of Citizen Diplomacy on the Russian-Alaska Frontier. And you can find that, I assume, in every local bookstore.
Correct.
My name is Charles Wolforth. Hometown Alaska is going on hiatus for the rest of the summer, so please join us again in the fall when Kathleen McCoy and I will be back. Many thanks to our producer, Dave Waldron, who does a wonderful job. I've enjoyed it. Now, we always love hearing about your ideas for shows, so please get in touch at hometown@alaskapublic.org, and thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.